Salve and salutations. My name is Charles Chestnut, this is Storied History, and this story is a continuation about the Mexican Revolution. We are on to episode 3. All right, so this is just a continuation. I'm not going to be rehashing all of the things that came before this. If you want, the first episode was about the three biggest figures, Francisco Madero, Pancho Villa, Emiliano Zapata, how they came to be, where they were, and how they began to interact. The second episode is pretty much the overthrowing of the dictator Diaz, how that happened and who was involved, and pretty much how it all fell apart quickly. And we're going to pick it up from there. So the other big figure, the really big figure here, is Henry Lane Wilson, the evil Henry Lane Wilson. He is the ambassador to Mexico from the United States. And I want to be very clear on this point. He was acting on his own behalf. He was not acting with any support of the United States government whatsoever. He was on his own. And he gets it in mind that he's going to overthrow the duly elected president of Mexico because he doesn't like him and because he doesn't like any of the things that he is doing. And he was a huge, huge fan of Porfirio Diaz, the dictator. So a year or so after he's elected, Madero's term in office is becoming very chaotic. He's losing the support of the people that had helped place him into power. All that was in the second episode. So the peasants in northern Mexico are still armed and raiding, and that was the biggest issue facing Madero at that point, or at least the most immediate. Madero sends the Mexican military to attack them, and that is when he loses the support of Pancho Villa, having already lost the support of Emiliano Zapata when he refused to enact land reform and told Zapata that he was no longer needed or necessary. Madero sends the military to attack the peasants and the revolutionaries in the north of Mexico. And in charge of that expedition is a man named Huerta. Huerta was the general who had hugged Diaz on his way out of Mexico and sworn loyalty to him. Madero had very stupidly kept him in charge of the military. He had not removed him and placed a loyal person in that position. Instead, he kept Diaz's lapdog or watchdog or attack dog, however you want to define that one. So Huerta goes to northern Mexico to find Pancho Villa to capture him and execute him. And he is successful in finding him and capturing him. And then right before they're going to kill him, Madero steps in and actually saves his life. So Pancho Villa survives. And having seen the writing on the wall, he leaves Mexico. He goes to Texas. He kind of becomes a retired folk hero and legend. In Mexico City, Madero is still trying to enact reforms. And one very small thing he wanted to do was he wanted the employees of the railroads in Mexico to be able to speak Spanish. He puts this out, and the evil Henry Lane Wilson goes absolutely berserk. He went crazy. To him, this was the straw that broke the camel's back, that the people in Mexico interacting with the people of Mexico should speak their language. To him, it's just, it is a bridge too far. It is an injustice that cannot be borne. So, on that unbelievable atrocity, and it really, it's amazing. This is a man that absolutely ignored and tolerated the worst abuses of the dictatorship of Diaz. He didn't even blink an eye at slaughtering entire villages. Loss of life meant absolutely nothing to him. But if you demand that a United States corporation have their employees speak Spanish in Mexico, well, that's just the worst possible. It's incredible. Anyway, so the evil Henry Lane Wilson explodes. He goes berserk. He's going to overthrow Madero because placing any restriction on the U.S. corporations is absolutely intolerable to him, even the smallest ones. So the evil Henry Lane Wilson begins to organize a coup. At this point, Madero has lost support on all sides. He doesn't have anybody. He has isolated himself from every single faction that had brought him to power. And he doesn't realize it. Madero was still having his daily conversations with the spirits, with the voices in his head, and they had convinced him that he's doing just fine, that everyone loves him, that there is no problem, and that he will continue on a long, long course to change Mexico forever. He doesn't know that he has lost the support of the ultra-wealthy because he was trying to enact reforms. He doesn't realize that the peasants in the South have abandoned him simply because Emiliano Zapata has abandoned him because he refused to do land reform, or at least did not actually do anything that was meaningful or quick. All he was really focusing on at that point was the stuff that the peasants did not really care about. So they're mad at him. The bandits in the North are not supporting him anymore because he had sent the army to attack them. And he's lost the support of the intellectuals and the middle class because his reforms were all superficial at this point, mainly the freedom of the press. So he's alone. And the army hates him because they're still loyal to Diaz. And apparently the United States is now mad at him because he's talking about railway employees speaking Spanish. Although that's a little bit tongue-in-cheek when I say that, because the only person who really was angry about this was the evil Henry Lane Wilson. The United States government did not care if the language restrictions were put into place. So now it's October 1912. It's about a year after he becomes president, and there is another rebellion. Felix Diaz, he's got a familiar name. He's the nephew of the previous dictator. And the evil Henry Lane Wilson rises and attempts to gather support for this rebellion. He's applauding the news. He's toasting it. He's trying to drum up support, and he loses. He has actually miscalculated that one completely. Although the evil Henry Lane Wilson really did love Diaz and wanted to restore a spectacularly brutal dictatorship, the rest of the country is very clear. They don't want Diaz or any type of Diaz back. They may not be happy with Madero, but trying to put Diaz or the nephew of Diaz back into dictatorial power was a non-starter. No one was going to support that, except, of course, for the evil Henry Lane Wilson. So the military goes and they puts down this very small rebellion, and the young Diaz was captured, defeated, and sentenced to death. And Madero, in typical fashion, he commutes the sentence and he doesn't kill him, which he probably should have, because that not being complete, let's say, on that point, kind of did not put down the talk of other rebellions that would have been more successful. So the evil Henry Lane Wilson has lost that little gambit. He was the one to support him, to try to drum up the actual military support. He had promised him that the United States would support his rebellion. It was a lie, and an obvious one, but it was believed. While this was happening, actually, the evil Henry Lane Wilson was trying to drum up support in the United States, and he was rebuffed wholeheartedly in Congress. He really has no influence. He's acting on his own. He has no support from the United States, from the legislative branch, or from the executive branch. But the thing is that the United States didn't really know what he was doing, and he certainly didn't tell them. Not about what he had just done with the young Diaz, and certainly not what he was about to do. So the new Diaz is in prison. Madero should have killed him, but he didn't. And in February of 1913, just a few months after the new Diaz had been captured but not executed, he was in prison. There were loyalist military groups that attacked that prison and freed him. So the new general, Felix Diaz, was technically released, but, you know, really just escaped from prison. And the evil Henry Lane Wilson's coup to actually depose Madero began. The duly elected, but now completely isolated, president of Mexico, Francisco Madero, was sleeping in Chapultepec Castle. This has been the traditional home for centuries of the leaders of Mexico. It is about a mile from the actual capital. His people wake him up and they inform him that there is a revolt in Mexico City. Francisco, believing again in his own ability and in the spirits to protect him, did something either incredibly reckless or incredibly brave, depending on your point of view, and probably both. And that was to go into Mexico City. Even though the city had been seized by the evil Henry Lane Wilson and some of the generals who were loyal to Diaz, including Huerta, the man who had hugged the old dictator, the only thing that Madero had was 300 cadets. These are students from the military academy, which at the time was right next to the castle, right next to where he was staying. So he went down there and got them, gathered them up, and brought them with him into Mexico City. They were in their uniforms. They were very, very lightly armed with whatever they could carry. Light firearms, nothing heavy. They rode that morning on horseback into Mexico City holding a Mexican flag. The people were absolutely astonished that he had actually showed up. And sensing the opportunity for some good entertainment just to see what was going to happen, they start following him. So the column of people gets larger and larger, even though it really is just the president, 300 cadets, and groups of random citizens from Mexico City. The column moves very slowly, and sometimes it actually has to stop because there are bullets being fired around them, although never a full-scale assault. If that had happened, they probably would have broken and ran. There are pictures of Francisco Madero being surrounded by people walking as he is trying to get back to the capital. The March of Loyalties is what it is called, and they're trying to return to the actual seat of power so that Madero can declare himself the president and that the rebellion has failed. It did not work out that way. The military units in the city were mixed. Some of them were pro-Madero and some of them were pro-coup, pro-Diaz. They were fighting in the streets of Mexico City. The loyalist group was the larger one, and they won the initial battle. But they did not extinguish the new rebels, and the evil Henry Lane Wilson's coup continued. This is what is called the 10 Tragic Days. On the first day alone, more than 800 people were killed, most of them civilians. They are fighting in Mexico City. They are not fighting in the fields. They're using machine guns, and in some cases, they're using howitzers, artillery, in the actual city. Madero places Huerta, the super Diaz supporter, in charge of the defense of Mexico City completely. He put everything under his control. Madero's brother warned him specifically that this is an incredibly stupid move. You cannot do this. He's going to betray you. Madero looked deep into Huerta's eyes and thought he saw loyalty. He believed that the spirits had told him that Huerta was a loyal man and loyal to Mexico and loyal to him. And so he ignored everyone's advice, ignored his own brother's advice. He placed Huerta as the key defender. And that was probably the biggest mistake of his entire life. It was a terrible idea because Huerta had already begun working with the evil Henry Lane Wilson. Wilson had organized the generals, and this is just jaw-dropping in its horror. What the generals had decided to do before this even began was to fight each other, but not to win. They were going to kill their own men and kill civilians in the process to create the illusion of absolute chaos, death, and destruction. Well, no, that's not true. It's not the illusion of chaos, death, and destruction. It is chaos, death, and destruction. That's all they wanted. All they wanted was death. The death of civilians and the death of their own troops. It was fake. It was a lie. Huerta is pretending to fight against the rebels so that Madero won't replace him, but he doesn't actually want to win. And as many of their own soldiers and civilians as that could be sacrificed were sacrificed. The evil Henry Lane Wilson's plan was successful. Each house in Mexico City had become a fortress. The windows are barricaded, the doors are barricaded. The women would run from the side of the street to the other to try to find food. Because when this all began, no one had prepared for it. So as the days passed, this is before the widespread use of electricity and refrigerators, so they may not have a lot of food. They were carrying white sheets, trying to show that they were neutral, hoping not to get shot as they're running around dodging piles of corpses, trying to find food and water. It was only the women running through the streets, because if it were the men, they were immediately killed. Many photographers actually risked their lives trying to capture the events, and thanks to them, we can actually see what has happened. There are hundreds, there are thousands of photographs documenting the level of destruction in the Capitol. There were families that had barricaded themselves in the center of their rooms, hoping that they would survive for long enough until the food ran out. There were huge piles of dead bodies being burned in the streets, in the parks, and in the fields, trying to prevent an epidemic. Soldiers were begging for water from houses and killing people if they didn't get it. It was a slaughter that was orchestrated by the generals on both sides. They had worked it out ahead of time, and to cause as much damage and destruction and death as they possibly could. The evil Henry Lane Wilson, the architect of this death, toasted their success, hosting dinner parties for the generals. This vile man, upon hearing of the thousands of dead civilians, smiled. The evil Henry Lane Wilson then began to demand that Francisco Madero resign. Madero, quite justifiably, very angry, threw him out, saying that he had no right to demand such a thing. You've got to understand the timing of this. Wilson has a very limited amount of time to do what he wants to do, because the president that had appointed him, William Howard Taft, is on his way out. He has lost the election and he is leaving office. And the new president, Woodrow Wilson — there is no relation whatsoever between the two of them, they just have the same last name. The evil Henry Lane Wilson knew that Woodrow Wilson would stop everything that he was doing if he gets in and he finds out. And the problem is, for the evil Wilson, is that President Taft didn't really want to get involved. This is the very end of his term in office, and he wants out. He's going to go away and retire, and he does not want, a few weeks before he leaves, to get involved with another revolution in Mexico. He had also been a big supporter of Madero's, at the behest of Madero's family when they were in Washington, D.C. lobbying for change. That was back in the last episode. So the evil Wilson was rebuffed by Taft at that point. Time passes and the fighting continues. The evil Henry Lane Wilson hosting dinner parties where the generals are officially fighting each other, but unofficially are celebrating around his table. He then weighs in on who's going to be the next president. They even go so far as to appoint a cabinet as to who would be the next leaders of Mexico. By the night of February 22nd, Madero was just trying to sleep, but he was curled up in a ball just crying. He couldn't go on. He had just been told that his brother Gustavo had been brutally tortured and murdered at the orders of Huerta and with the support of Henry Lane Wilson, the vile man. It was at this point that his mother convinced him to actually flee the country. This is late, but she's not wrong. So he leaves the National Palace. He goes to get in a car. He's driving away and the car is stopped. He is forced out of the vehicle and he is shot to death in the streets. The evil Henry Lane Wilson had been successful. Huerta was appointed the new president of Mexico. President Woodrow Wilson got involved almost immediately when he took office. He was informed of what had happened, and he then discovered what the evil Henry Lane Wilson had done. President Wilson accused Henry Lane Wilson of treason, perfidy, and assassination, and an unauthorized assault on a constitutional government. He attempted to have him criminally charged, but was unsuccessful. There was just enough plausible deniability to get free, and obviously the Mexican generals would not admit to what they had done. It was not until much, much later that the entire abhorrent business actually saw the light of day. The new U.S. president dismissed the ambassador. The evil Henry Lane Wilson attempted to have the United States recognize General Huerta as the legitimate government of Mexico. President Woodrow Wilson refused to do so because of the manner that he had been placed into power, which opened the door for yet another armed rebellion. The evil Henry Lane Wilson never returned to a position of power or authority. He died in 1932, and the world instantly became a better place. He is buried in the Crown Hill Cemetery in Indianapolis, Indiana. So if anyone is in Indianapolis and they have a little bit too much to drink and want to find a place to go relieve themselves, I cannot think of a better one. Now, while all of this was happening, Pancho Villa had seen which way the wind was blowing, and he had left Mexico. So he was living in Texas. He had walked away from his banditry. He's living in El Paso, just across the border. He was staying in a hotel, or in a kind of an extended stay, under his real name, Dorotio Arango. He kept carrier pigeons in his room to communicate with his allies in Chihuahua, which is a state located in the northern parts of Mexico. He returned to civilian life. He was literally riding his motorcycle through the streets of El Paso. And in the afternoons, he would sit at a bar. And sometimes he would go to a little sweet shop where he would have his favorite little dessert, which was vanilla ice cream and strawberry soda. And the idea that Pancho Villa used to sit in the afternoons and just eat ice cream and strawberry soda is delightful to me. So for the time being, for several months, he's just an anonymous Mexican living in Texas, enjoying his treats. But then the coup happened, and his friend Madero had been murdered. Pancho Villa had called him Madrito because he was so small. And he loved him and respected him, even though they disagreed on a great deal. And even though he had warned him about the supporters that he was alienating, and even though Madero had ordered Huerta to go capture him, Pancho Villa still loves the guy. So when he is murdered and Huerta actually took power, Pancho Villa did not react well. He is very angry. He leaves Texas. He leaves his motorcycle. He leaves his ice cream and strawberry soda. Pancho Villa now believes that it's up to him to continue the fight. He goes back to Mexico to raise military units, to raise his people back, and he is heavily supported. Because Madero may have been an ineffectual president, but when he was killed, everybody in Mexico knew what was going to happen. I mean, he knew what had happened. This was not hidden. It had been a coup, and the guy that had been officially in charge of defending the city against the rebels is now the president. You can't get that way unless everything has been arranged beforehand. Everybody knows it, although nobody can prove it. Huerta was not popular. He was an incredibly heavy drinker. The guy was basically drunk 24 hours a day. He is known for his cruelty. Like, that's his reputation. Which is why he had been Diaz's top general, because he was such a cruel bastard. So when he takes power, the factions that had united to overthrow Diaz unite once again. The revolution wasn't over. So they don't have Madero to rally around, but they're still going to fight, because they certainly do have a common enemy. You have Zapata in the south, you have Pancho Villa in the north, and you have a new guy, Carranza. Carranza was the governor of one of the larger states. He had been appointed by Madero, and he absolutely refused to recognize Huerta's authority. He was a legitimate person that stood up and said, we are rejecting this man as an authority. We do not accept him as president of Mexico. And we're going to have elections. Because Huerta had not come to power through an election. It is at this point that Pancho Villa achieves the height of his fame. This is where he really is elevated from a folk hero to a near mythological one. He is doing what he does best. He is a bandit that is also fighting for the people. He is attacking government houses. He is attacking small groups of federal soldiers. He is robbing trains. At one point, he robs a Wells Fargo train and takes 122 bars of silver. He goes to the big haciendas and he assesses them and makes them pay taxes. They now have to pay taxes to Pancho Villa. And he is using that money to fund his revolution. He also gets taxes money from actual taxes. When the taxes were being gathered for whatever reason, for whatever place, for an official capacity, he would attack those places and take the cash. He is a hero to the people because he gives some of the money back to the people. And a huge amount was kept for funding the actual revolution, for food for his soldiers, horses, weapons, ammunition, everything that you need to actually fight. He does not become a wealthy man through stealing. He's not a real bandit. He's a gentleman bandit, I suppose. One of the few actual ones. The train that he had robbed with 122 bars of silver, he gave some of the silver back to the miners who had actually mined the ore themselves, and the smelters who had actually smelted the ores. He fights a series of very daring battles where his cavalry charges were successful. He was not a brilliant tactician. He would basically just charge the cavalry and then do it again until they were successful. The huge portion of the mythos that expanded around Pancho Villa came from one guy. He's a guy named John Reed. John Reed was an American journalist. He wrote magazine articles, and he spent 4 months living with Pancho Villa's army, publishing these extensive descriptions of the fighting men and women. And women, yes, the soldadas. These are the ladies. These are Mexican women who are fighting, actually fighting, as part of the revolution. At some point, Pancho Villa was using some of the money that he was taking to fund butcher shops. These butcher shops were being stocked with the cattle that he was stealing from the haciendas, so that the very poor peasants could go to the butcher shop, and if the local butcher, the local guy, the local representative of Pancho Villa, if he knew that you were actually a destitute, starving person, you would get your meat for free. And if you are the children or of someone who is fighting with Pancho Villa, you would get it for free. If you are the wife or the mother or the old father of one of Pancho Villa's soldiers, you would get the meat for free. This keeps his soldiers loyal to him, but it also keeps them from feeling like they have to leave the revolution to go feed their families. It works very well. It works so well that it's kind of a surprise that this is the only time that something like this happens. So they're feeding the poor with the stolen cattle, and they're funding the butcher shops with stolen money, and they're fighting everybody, and while he has magazine articles being written about him, he becomes the legend. By 1913, he is then elected the governor of the state of Chihuahua, which was against the wishes of Carranza, who wanted to appoint someone else. But he declares Chihuahua to be an independent state. Well, not fully independent, but just in rebellion against Huerta, along with some of the other northern states, Carranza's in particular. He prints his own currency, and as part of the law that he imposes in Chihuahua, it is required to be traded and accepted at exactly the same exchange rate of the Mexican pesos. He forces a lot of the wealthy people in the state to give loans to fund his revolution. He confiscates the gold from many, many of the banks. He takes hostages. A man from the Terraza family. Now, the Terraza family is the one that specifically said, and I covered this in the previous episodes, I don't want lawyers, I just want farmhands. They are the ones that were actively blocking any attempt to educate the people in their lands. If you tried to establish a school or teach the peasants to read, he would kill you, because he did not want his subjects to be literate. And this is the guy that whose family owns 27,000 square miles of land. So he takes some hostages from the family, and he holds them hostage until they actually do reveal that they had been controlling the banks the entire time and where the banks had stored their gold, the hidden gold reserves of the bank. And there was a lot more than anybody had ever realized, that even Pancho Villa had hoped for, because they had taken so much from so many people for so long and had just hidden it all away. And Pancho takes that. He takes a page out of Zapata's book, and he decreed that after the revolution, although not at this time, the land would be redistributed, that the land reform would happen in the same vein as in the southern parts of Mexico, and that the peasants would have the land that had been taken from them and stolen by the Terraza family, they would get it back. At this point, he has money just pouring in from all sides, both legal and illegal and quasi-legal. He expands, he modernizes his forces, he buys cavalry horses, arms, ammunition. He starts funding mobile hospital facilities. He's got railroad cars that have been retrofitted to be hospital vehicles or hospital cars. He's got doctors and nurses on staff to treat his wounded. He goes north into Texas. He sends his people north, and he's recruiting volunteers to come down and fight for him, and people do. His legend is growing, and everyone just adores him. He creates a large army known as the Division del Norte, the Division of the North. And at this point, it is the most powerful and feared military unit in all of Mexico. He moves south, winning just battle after battle after battle after battle. His men are very enthusiastic about what they're doing, and they're going up against people that are just paid soldiers that really don't have any loyalty to Huerta's regime and don't really particularly like him anyway. And Pancho Villa, the mythical figure, they don't put up a huge amount of resistance. So he eventually comes to the heart of Huerta's regime, and, well, we'll get to that. So as Pancho Villa is advancing from the north, Emiliano Zapata, much less flamboyantly, but is not less effective, he is advancing from the south. Yes, what Emiliano Zapata was doing was incredibly important. Yes, absolutely necessary. Yes, it was vital. Was it quite as flamboyantly interesting as Pancho Villa? No. So we're not going to cover all those details because they're not, it doesn't really make a good story, and you have the important parts. Now, at this point, Huerta knows he is doomed. At this point, he is just a wannabe dictator who cannot dictate. This is a man who, in his rage, he even stopped pretending to be a legitimate president, and he was just having his death squads go out and kill people. The United States has still refused to recognize his regime, although they are not officially supporting Carranza. They will not recognize Huerta, and Wilson is essentially saying, hands off, you guys sort this out on your own. And you can also see the writing on the wall. Everybody knew what was coming, as victories in the north and victories in the south were just squeezing Huerta. The evil Henry Lane Wilson has been removed by this point. Just as a side note, one of the reasons that Zapata absolutely refused to support Huerta, no matter what, one of the reasons he hated him so much was because Huerta had been the guy who was in charge of putting down the peasant uprising in the southern parts of Mexico. So several episodes back, I talked about how the army would actually literally come in and kill every man, woman, and child in a village if they thought the village was harboring any people that were rebelling. In some cases, they were literally slaughtering infants. And that was Huerta. That was Huerta's doing. So Zapata absolutely hated him, viciously hated him. So Huerta knows he's losing, and he reaches out. He knows he can't find, he knows he can't fight a war on two fronts. So Pancho Villa, coming from the north, and Huerta turns to the south, to Zapata, and he reaches out to him and tries to make peace. And Zapata said no. The first time it was just peace, like, hey, put down your weapons, we won't fight each other. Zapata says no. Then he offers him a bribe, and Zapata said no. Then he offered him a huge bribe, and Zapata said no. Then he offered him the land reform that Zapata had been asking for, but only for himself and his closest friends, not for everybody, and Zapata said no. And then he offered him a title, massive amounts of land, some reform for the people, and to give him everything he asked for as long as he would not stop fighting and stop attacking and stop breaking up the other big haciendas, and Zapata says no. So Huerta is like a rat. He is a drunken, cornered rat. He finally loses the support of the Catholic Church and most of the press, and he really is just on his own. So he responds by shutting down the legislature. He just declares that there is no more legislative branch, that it is he and he alone. It's almost like a Star Wars moment there, where the emperor literally just says, there is no more Senate, it is only me. Well, this is real life. Huerta has dissolved the legislature. Pancho Villa almost gets to the gates of Mexico City, and then he's diverted. Carranza, the governor who's trying to reestablish democracy, tells him that he's got to go take another city, take a stronghold, a capital, a very important one to be sure. But, you know, was that really the entire reason? Because Villa did it. Pancho Villa did it. He did what he was asked to do. He went and he took the other city. If he hadn't gone, he easily would have been able to move into Mexico City. Now, it's possible that Carranza was trying to do the smart thing, which is to make sure that there are no strongholds of dictator support as you're moving south. You don't want to bypass what could then attack you from behind. That's true. It's also true that if Pancho Villa had moved into Mexico City, well, maybe his bandits would have been doing bandit things. And it's also possible that he was so popular at this point and such a legend in his own time that if he had gone into Mexico City alone or with his army, would he have ended up the new leader of Mexico? Would that have happened? I don't know. Maybe. Or I think the safest way to say this is that Carranza certainly was concerned that that might have happened. So finally, Huerta is cornered. He cannot do anything anymore. He has lost all support. He has nothing. I mean, the evil Henry Lane Wilson, who has 100% would have supported him, but he has thankfully has no power anymore and cannot do anything. So Huerta turns to the only people he think that might help him, and that's the Germans in World War I. So yeah, he's going to try to ally with Germany, and they turn him down. The Germans said no. So he's completely isolated. Now he's all on his own. So he flees. He takes as much gold and paper currency as he can, and he runs away, like the drunken rat that he was. He goes to the only direction he could. You can't go north, because that's Pancho Villa. You can't go south, because that's Emiliano Zapata. You can't go west because the mountains are blocking you. The only way to get out is to go east. So he goes east. And now he's in the Gulf of Mexico. Where are you going to go? Nobody's going to take you in. You can't go over to Europe. They're literally in the middle of World War I. You can't go to the south because he was very, very unpopular in the Central American and South American countries. So where are you going to go? Well, he goes to the United States. He flees to the United States, and he is arrested in Fort Bliss, Texas. The U.S. throws him in jail. This is President Wilson's revenge for the evil Henry Lane Wilson and his plan. He takes Huerta and he throws him in prison, and Huerta dies 6 months later. But now what the hell are they going to do? It's exactly the same problem they had months before, when you've defeated the dictator and all the disparate groups came together, but what are you going to do? Well, the first thing to do is celebrate. So they did. Carranza called for a meeting of the victors in October 1914 to come to Mexico City, which Carranza had now controlled. And this story will be concluded in the next episode. Yep, there's going to be four. And in the next episode, I will explain to you why I do not believe that Pancho Villa would have been the leader, even if he had gone into Mexico City. I will tell you what happened to Emiliano Zapata. I will tell you what happened to Pancho Villa. I will tell you who ended up controlling Mexico, how they died, and who took over after them. And I will explain the roots and the origins of the single-party rule that then dominated Mexican politics for the next 90 years. Or 85 years. I'm going to close this by saying I do realize this went longer than I anticipated, but I just had so much I get so much enjoyment out of doing this. It is sometimes hard work, but it is a pleasure to be able to condense these things. And when it's like a discovery. When you're reading all this dry history, sometimes you come across something that is really, really like a diamond in the rough. And sometimes the really great moments of discovery is when I have an epiphany of how to tell a story the most effective way. And it was, for me, for this one, it absolutely was when I realized that telling the story of the revolution by explaining the actions of the three primary movers was the best way to do it. And once I got that down, everything just kind of crystallized. But getting to that point was difficult. But enjoyable, and I do hope that you have enjoyed it. If you did, please, I hid the subscribe button somewhere. We'll get episode 4 to you very, very shortly. And yes, I do mean very shortly, because I'm going to be finishing this one probably in the next few days, and it'll be up a week or two, most likely two, after this one actually goes up. Thank you so much for listening, and I will talk to you in the next episode.
Storied History is written and recorded by Charles Chestnut in New Orleans, Louisiana, with audio production and original music by Seamus O'Connor. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe, and we'll see you soon.